Hey, all you true crime fans, this is Mike Ferguson.
And this is Mike Morphin.
And we'd like to invite you to listen to our podcast, Criminology.
Launched in 2017, we've covered a variety of strange cases from murders to missing persons.
We dive into a variety of cases in both the U.S. and abroad.
Some of the cases are ones you may not have heard of, like the Pocatello babysitter murders or the canal murders.
Other cases we cover are some of the most historic in true crime, like the Tylenol murders and the Lindbergh kidnapping. We also dive into cases that are currently breaking thanks to DNA and forensic genealogy.
Sometimes you'll hear from people connected to the cases, like the interview we did with the brother-in-law of the Golden State Killer, Joseph DeAngelo.
There are close to 200 episodes of Criminology available to binge on right now, including full seasons covering the Zodiac Killer, the Golden State Killer, and Ted Bundy. And new episodes come out every Saturday night.
Subscribe to Criminology today, wherever you listen to your podcast.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. I've discussed how love triangles are a popular trope in true crime, how the phrase is salacious clickbait, and how overused and misused it is. The problem I've found is that usually when someone calls a case a love triangle, at least one of the people in the triangle is unaware. They are being cheated on. That's not a triangle. That's an affair. But today, we have a true triangle. A man and his wife are having an affair with the same man. And they both knew about it. There were the usual feelings of hurt and betrayal. And of course, shame. This was the 80s. Gay rights activists had made many strides in the 60s and 70s. But then the outbreak of AIDS happened. Gay people faced new discrimination and hostility. It seemed that homophobia had reached new heights. Activists fought back. People came out of the closet, refusing to be ashamed. But in 1984, it was still very hard. Especially if you were a married gay man who had tried to conform but led a hidden life. And even harder if you were a Baptist minister. Welcome to episode 130, Twisted Love Triangle, The Murder of Dan Arnold. On July 18, 1984, Dan Arnold and his wife Donna attended the weekly service at their church, Emmanuel Baptist, in Clinton, North Carolina. Clinton is a small city with a small town culture. It had less than 8,000 residents in 1984. It's the county seat of Sampson County. Sampson County was established in April 1784, following the American Revolutionary War, in the southeast corner of the state, known as the Coastal Plains. It's a beautiful part of the country, bursting with green, rolling hills, farmland, as well as creeks and rivers. It has a lovely temperate climate, not too cold in the winter, and not too hot in the summer. Before the first Scots-Irish immigrants settled in the area, the Coharie Native American tribe lived in the lush watersheds of Black and South Rivers, as well as Six Run Creek. Today they live on the Great Coharie River, which flows through Sampson County and winds south for nearly 50 miles before it merges into the Black River, also known as the River of Ancient Cypress Groves. Coharie means driftwood, and their ancestral ties to the river and the land remain strong today. Nestled between the gorgeous white sand beaches of the East Coast and the majestic Appalachian Mountains of the West, the county of Sampson and the town of Clinton are just an hour's drive from the state capital. Clinton is very racially diverse and moderately conservative, with nearly 50 churches serving the area, and almost half of those churches are Baptist. The Emmanuel Baptist Church is a large red brick building with one white steeple. Established in 1956, the church is located on Sunset Avenue. In 1984, Dan Arnold served as the minister of music. The evening of July 18th was typical for Dan and his wife Donna. Both were very active in the church. After the Wednesday night service, Dan and Donna stayed for choir practice and then sorted hymnals with other church members, including Michelle Honeycutt and her daughter. When they were finished, the Arnolds invited Michelle and her daughter to go back to their house so they could practice the piano. So at around 9:30 p.m., the group left the church and drove to the nearby Arnold home. Once there, during the piano lesson, Donna began having issues with her contact lenses. She looked for her lens case, but realized she'd left it in her purse and left her purse at the church. Donna told her husband that she was going to pop out quickly to go get it, but he said no, he would go get it for her, so she didn't have to stop piano practice. Donna told her husband that she really didn't need her purse because she had what she needed at home, but Dan insisted. Dan left the house around 10:15 p.m. and drove to the church. Soon, Donna realized that half an hour had passed since her husband left, and she became a little worried. The church was close to the Arnold home, and she had expected him back by then. Donna called Dan's office at the church, saying he might have gotten caught up in some task, but no one answered the phone. Michelle, who was still with Donna, drove her friend and their children to the church to search for Dan in case something had gone wrong. They pulled into the church parking lot and were horrified to see Dan's bloody body on the ground. Donna started screaming. She wanted to get out of the car and go to Dan. But Michelle put the car in reverse before she got a chance and drove them to a nearby gas station where she called the police. As police arrived on the scene, Michelle drove a now hysterical Donna back to the church, where she had to hold Donna back from going to Dan's body. Michelle later said Donna eventually became calm, as if in a state of shock. As they arrived on the scene, investigators wondered why anyone would murder the respected local minister. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Robert Daniel Arnold Jr. was born on May 26, 1951, to parents Robert and Marjorie Arnold in Washington, D.C. There's not much I was able to find on Dan's early life or childhood, but we know he attended college and met his future wife Donna around that time. They were both just 22 when they got married. Donna Marie Jones was born on July 19, 1952, to parents Paul and Marjorie in Kansas. Donna attended college for several years and had a fondness for listening to and playing music. On July 15, 1973, Dan and Donna married in Bridgewater, Virginia. Soon they had two daughters and moved from Bridgewater to Fredericksburg. They stayed in Fredericksburg until 1979 when they moved to Clinton, North Carolina, so Dan could become the minister of music at Emmanuel Baptist. Donna played the organ for the church, and the couple was well known and liked by their fellow church members. On July 18, 1984, when police made it to the church parking lot, they found 33-year-old Dan had been bludgeoned, stabbed, and his throat had been cut. It was a gruesome crime scene. A purse, later identified as Donna Arnold's, was found near his body. The medical examiner found that Dan had been stabbed 8 times, with wounds reaching from his neck to his chest. One of these wounds, a deep stab to the chest, had been the cause of death. Some of the wounds were made while Dan was standing. His throat had been slit on both sides, and he had numerous superficial wounds in his back. Along with the stab wounds, Dan had blunt force trauma to the head. Investigators theorized that the head trauma could have been caused by a slapstick, a 10-inch-long metal shank covered by leather. It was clear that Dan had been ambushed in the brutal attack. Donna Arnold explained to police how she left her purse at the church that evening, and Dan went to retrieve it. She said she had no idea who murdered her husband. She and Michelle Honeycutt found his body after he had been gone too long. There wasn't a whole lot to go off at the scene of the murder, but as they spoke with friends and acquaintances of Dan's, police became suspicious of 2 people in his life. They suspected that these 2 people might have been involved in his death and made arrangements to bring each of them in for questioning. These 2 people were Dan's wife, Donna Arnold, and a man named Carl Stuffel. Carl Edward Stuffel was born on December 9, 1962. He had an unusual childhood, and according to him, he had started taking drugs when he was just 10 years old. From an early age, Carl was a career criminal. When Carl met Dan, he was facing charges for larceny of a firearm, the latest in a string of arrests. January 1979, breaking and entering. April 1979, another breaking and entering. After he was released from prison in August of 1980, in July of 1981, Carl was convicted of receiving stolen goods, but got out on early release, and in early 1982, he was convicted of conspiracy to commit felony breaking and entering. He was released in July of 1983. He never served more than a year, despite his record and the sentence he was given. And by early 1984, he was out and ready to make trouble again. But trouble actually walked into his day job. Carl was a barber at a small shop in a mall in Raleigh. He got his barber's license in prison during his last stint. Dan Arnold had walked in for a haircut. Investigators learned that Carl Stuffel and Dan Arnold had become close in the months before his murder, and that the Arnold family had been helping Carl face his personal demons, getting him into rehab. They also heard rumors that the relationship between the Arnolds and Carl was complicated and toxic. On the morning of July 19th, the day after Dan's death, Michelle Honeycutt was still at the Arnold house, helping out, taking care of Donna and the girls. While she was there, she overheard a phone call between Carl and Donna, where Carl wished Donna a happy birthday. Michelle listened in on the conversation and later told police that when Donna told Carl that Dan had been murdered, Carl feigned surprise and was not very convincing. Within the first week of Dan's death, investigators interviewed Donna Arnold and Carl several times. Donna repeated her version of events that night, never straying from the details. Carl also denied any involvement with the murder. A couple of weeks into the investigation, Donna finally broke, and police learned the extent of the Arnolds' relationship to Carl. On August 3, 1984, Donna delivered a handwritten statement to the police. In the statement, she detailed the events leading to Dan's death, including, to their surprise, that both she and her husband had each had a brief romantic relationship with Carl Stuffel, separately. Earlier that year, according to Donna, Dan had admitted to her that he was gay, and that before bringing Carl into their lives, he had slept with him once. On Valentine's Day that year, Dan Arnold was commuting from Clinton, North Carolina, to Wake Forest to attend classes at Southeastern Baptist Seminary. While driving, Dan decided to stop by the Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh to look around for a bit. The barber shop located in the mall caught his eye, and Dan figured he might as well get a haircut. Inside the shop, Dan met a young hairstylist, 21-year-old Carl Stuffel, who sat Dan in his chair and gave the minister a trim. Carl and Dan hit it off, chatting about their work. Dan invited Carl out for dinner, and that evening after dinner, they rented a motel room in Raleigh for the night, where they had sex for the first time. Over the next few weeks, Dan would stop into the mall every so often to visit with Carl. During these visits, Dan learned about Carl's history with drugs and his stints in prison. He felt sympathetic to the handsome young man and was convinced he could help him with his addiction problems. So after knowing the man for just a few weeks, he invited Carl to move in with him and his family. Donna said when she found out, she said she didn't think Carl should stay with him due to his criminal record, his issues with drugs, and the possible effect his presence could have on their daughters. But Dan persisted, and he took his family to meet Carl and his parents. And Donna slowly became more comfortable with the idea. At this point, she had no idea about her husband's intimate night with Carl or any other affairs he had had. By the end of April, Carl was moved into the Arnold home. Shortly after Carl moved in, Donna found a canceled check to a Raleigh motel. She confronted Dan about it, but he made up an excuse. That evening, he and Carl left to take the babysitter home. Before they left, Dan gave his wife a long letter to read. In the letter, Dan explained to Donna that he had been gay since he was a child. He said he'd had sex with men in every place they'd ever lived. Dan also admitted to having a one-night affair with Carl, which explained the motel receipt from Raleigh. Donna was beside herself. She left the house, drove around for hours, and considered leaving Dan. But after circling around for quite some time, she decided she still loved him and that their marriage and family were worth saving. And then the very next day, Donna started her own sexual relationship with Carl. Donna said Carl encouraged her to have an affair with him so she could get back at Dan. Donna claimed she gave in to Carl on three occasions. She would later insist he raped her. Dan learned of the affair between his wife and Carl when he found them in bed together. Donna wrote that after Dan told her he was gay, Carl started vindictively dominating Donna whenever they were around her husband by touching her and putting Dan down. This ridicule upset Dan so much that he sought medical help for the stress, crying to his doctor on May 18, 1984, as he told him about Donna's affair and his low self-esteem. He told his doctor that he was worried that Carl was younger and better looking, and the doctor prescribed Dan a mild tranquilizer. A few days later, on May 22nd, Carl asked Daniel Staton, a friend of Dan's, where he could buy some weed. Staton told Dan about the conversation, and Dan used this to tell Carl he needed to leave. Carl went back to Raleigh, but by early June, he reached out to the Arnolds for help. He said he was sick from drugs, and he called the Arnolds and begged them to send him to a facility, the Dorothea Dix Hospital, so he could undergo detox. What kind of drugs Carl was on is not in the court transcripts or newspapers. Dan and Donna agreed to help him. After dropping Carl off at rehab, the Arnolds left for a week in the mountains, but they made sure to write and call Carl often. When they returned, they would visit Carl at the hospital and take him out on day and weekend passes. It seemed like their relationships with one another were on the mend. But in July of 1984, Dan found out that Donna and Carl were still having an affair. Donna cried and apologized, and Dan said that was it. He'd had enough. He forgave his wife, and they brought Carl's car and belongings to Raleigh, though he was still in the hospital, and told him he could never come back to their home. Then Dan took his family, along with Daniel Staton and his wife, to the beach for a trip. While there, at Dan's request, Staton confronted Donna about her affair with Carl, and Donna stayed silent, but burst into tears. On July 12th, Carl was discharged from the hospital. He did not try to return to the Arnolds. Instead, he went to live with a friend named Gerald Tart and his family. Donna told investigators that she had kept this information from them because she didn't want Dan's homosexuality to damage his reputation in the church and community. Donna's statement confirmed some of the suspicions police had about Carl and the Arnolds, but it did nothing to prove that Donna or Carl were involved in the minister's murder. Shortly after giving the letter to police, Donna collected a $200,000 life insurance payout and moved her daughters back to Virginia, hoping to leave North Carolina for good. Later that year, on December 4th, Carl was convicted of the larceny of firearms charge and was sentenced to 3 years in prison. With both of their main suspects out of the picture, the investigation into Dan Arnold's murder came to a standstill. Nearly 2 years after the murder, on March 2nd, 1986, Carl Steffel was released from prison, and like Donna, he relocated to Virginia, but to a different city. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. As I'm moving along in my recovery from my last back surgery, I'm excited that my mobility is getting better. I'm walking more and always have a podcast in my ear. That's why I love my new Raycon earbuds. They came with several different size gel tips, so I could pick the right size. Finally, comfortable earbuds that don't fall out. And the new everyday earbuds look, feel, and sound better than ever. I chose the rose gold. They are sleek and stylish. And I love the charging case with the rope handle. It's so easy to find in my messy purse. There are three sound profiles to make sure you're getting just the right amount of bass. Pure mode, balanced mode, and bass mode. It's awesome to switch modes when I go from a podcast to music. And there's a new awareness mode for me when I'm not at home and need to listen to my surroundings. Raycons also have a 32-hour battery life, which is great. I can get all my chores done without having to stop and recharge. And with a built-in mic, I can take calls on my earbuds with the push of a button. They start at half the price of other premium audio brands. And Raycons also come with a 45-day happiness guarantee. So you've got nothing to lose for giving them a shot. Right now, Southern Fried listeners can get 15% off their Raycon order at buyraycon.com/southernfried. That's buyraycon.com/southernfried to save 15% on Raycons. buyraycon.com/southernfried. It seemed as if there would be no further developments in the Dan Arnold murder case, despite the great deal of media coverage it had received early on. But this changed in the beginning of 1987, when one of Carl Steffel's friends and partners in crime was arrested. In January of 1987, Gerald Tart, Carl's longtime friend who he lived with, was arrested for theft. His mother, Barbara, who often participated in crimes with her son and Carl, went to the investigators on Dan's case. She wanted to help her son cut a deal, and she had some shocking new evidence. Barbara shared copies of letters written by Donna to Carl after Carl was released from the hospital back in July of 1984, the same month that Dan was murdered. Barbara told police that she found the letters and Carl's stuff while he was living in her home in 1984. According to Barbara, her attorney had advised her to return the letters to Carl, but when she did, he burned them. Gerald and Carl didn't know that Barbara had copied the letters before returning them. The letters expressed Donna's love for Carl and her hopes for a future that they could share together. They dated back to the time that Carl had been committed to the Dorothea Dix Hospital, away from Donna and her husband's home. One of the letters, dated July 9th, 9 days before Dan's murder, read, "Dearest Carl, on my way downtown, so I thought I'd scribble a quick hello before I go. Please excuse fancy writing paper. I love you and hope your day is going well. I'm so proud of you for going through the detox program, and I pray that you will never be troubled by drugs or alcohol again. Your body is too precious to ever be messed up again. I know you are happy to be breathing some good fresh air, and I'm really happy for you. Hope your job hunting will be successful. How I long to be near you, Carl. Love always, Donna." Another letter, dated July 11th, reads, "Dear Carl, hello. Hope you are having a good day. Have been thinking of you constantly. How is your new job? Do you have to travel far from Gerald's to go to work? Words cannot fully express to you how anxious I am for Wednesday to be here. I have real fears for your safety, though. Our someday is so close. Please know that I love you with all of my heart and want so very much for you to be happy. We will make a good team. Hope you are smiling. The girls and I miss you so much. All my love, Donna." Dan Arnold had been murdered 1 week after this letter on Wednesday, July 18th, the day referenced in the letter. Police thought they had their first real piece of evidence connecting Donna and Carl to Dan's death. Barbara also gave police a card inside an envelope addressed to Carl, which was dated July 10th. A note at the top of the card read, "They are telling you you are a thought that just happens now and then. You come to mind in special ways time and time again." "Time and time again" was underlined. The writing continued, "Carl, have a really great day and know that I am thinking of you and loving you in every way. Keep focusing on our someday. Love always, Donna." Police now knew that Donna's relationship with Carl was much more romantic and serious than she had let on, a secret romance that may have been the motive for Dan's murder. Police also suspected that Gerald Hart knew more about the murder than he was letting on. His pending criminal charges for larceny might make him willing to rat on his buddy Carl. When they questioned Gerald, he insisted he did not kill Dan, but he did drive Carl from Raleigh to Clinton, and then back home again on the evening of July 18th. He said because Carl didn't want his car to be seen in the area that night. Investigators struck a deal with Gerald. If he gave police information about Dan's murder and testified against Carl and Donna, he would be granted immunity for his part in the murder, which would at least be aiding and abetting Carl Steffel. And he would also receive probation for the larceny charge. Gerald told police that once in Clinton on July 18th, he parked his car in a shopping center parking lot. He said the Arnold residence was visible from the parking lot and the church was nearby. Carl got out of the car and left while Gerald went to McDonald's to get something to eat. Gerald said he went back and waited in the car, and Carl returned about an hour later. He told investigators that when Carl got in the car, he had his shirt in his hands and had blood on his forearms and hands. An 8-inch scuba diving knife was rolled up in the shirt. Carl told Gerald, "Hurry up and get out of here." Gerald said he asked what happened, and Carl said that he and Dan got into a fight. As they drove back to Raleigh, he said Carl told him he wished it had not happened, but he couldn't change it. And then he said Carl did not elaborate. Carl then told Gerald to stop by a creek or river so they could throw his camouflaged clothes and the scuba diving knife out. After disposing of the items, Carl changed into some spare clothes. Gerald said Carl did not explicitly admit that he had killed Dan, but he did tell Gerald that if he told anyone about what happened that night, that he'd, quote, take him down with him. When they got back to Raleigh, they went into Gerald's house and showered. Following this statement, Gerald passed a polygraph that supposedly verified he didn't participate in the assault or murder of Dan. Of course, we know polygraphs are inadmissible for many reasons. With the letters from Donna and Gerald's statement, the state felt like they had enough evidence to charge Donna and Carl. Both were arrested on February 7, 1987, and charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. Donna told the authorities that she didn't write the letters and maintained her innocence. On March 26th, Carl Steffel took a plea deal. In exchange for pleading guilty, Carl's first charge would be lowered to second degree. He wouldn't be sentenced until after Donna's trial. Up until this point, Carl had not implicated Donna in her husband's murder, but when he pled guilty, he changed his tune. Carl said that he, Gerald, and Donna plotted to kill Dan both before and after Carl was released from his stay at the Dorothea Dix Hospital. Carl said he and Donna were in love, and Donna asked him to kill Dan because she thought a divorce would be too hard on the kids. Carl said he agreed only because he loved Donna, not because he wanted to hurt Dan. According to Carl, he and Donna brainstormed different ways to kill Dan. Apparently, there had been several other potential murder plots. Donna suggested someone attack Dan at night while he was walking the family dog. But then, according to Carl, she had a different idea. The next time Donna visited Carl, she brought him a key to the church. On three occasions, Carl had Gerald Tart visit him at the hospital. Gerald had to use a fake name because the hospital didn't want him visiting. They were worried he would bring Carl drugs. During one of the visits, Carl asked Gerald to kill Dan on the 4th of July. Carl gave Gerald a map and a key to the church, which he said Donna had given to him. Carl said Donna was supposed to send Dan back to the church to get her purse after choir practice, and that's when Gerald would kill Dan. On June 30th, while on a day pass from the hospital, Carl and the Arnold family went swimming at the Haynes Barton Pool in Raleigh. Gerald Tart met them there. Gerald later testified that while there, Donna asked him if he could, quote, help them with their problem. When she asked, Dan was playing with the children and was out of earshot. Gerald said he didn't think he could help them, and then he said Carl looked over at the pool and said he would like to drown Dan. On July 4th, according to Carl, Gerald went to the church Dan worked at. Donna went through with her part. After leaving choir practice, Donna told Dan that she'd left her purse in the church. Carl said that as Dan went back to the church, Gerald noticed that there were police officers in the area, so he didn't kill Dan. After this, Gerald gave the key back to Carl and destroyed the map. Carl said at one point, Donna offered him and Gerald $10,000 to kill Dan, so it does seem like she was looking ahead to that insurance payout. They finally landed on the plan of killing Dan on July 18th at the church. Donna would again say she left her purse at the church, and Dan would go back to get it. That's when Carl and Gerald would kill him. Carl said he spoke with Donna on July 17th and made sure she still wanted Dan dead. Donna said yes. Carl said that on July 18th, he and Gerald discussed their plans to kill Dan during the drive from Raleigh to Clinton. He said they stopped just outside of Clinton and changed clothes in the woods. Carl said he put on a painter's cap to kind of shield his face. And the pair drove around Clinton, smoked weed until dark, and then parked near the church. Once there, they hid in a wooded area behind the church. Carl said both he and Gerald had scuba knives from a robbery they had committed a few days earlier, after he moved in with the Tart family. On the night of the attack, Carl said Gerald also brought a slapjack with them. When Dan came down the church steps, Carl said that Gerald jumped out and attacked him. Then Carl jumped out and drew his knife, which was strapped to his leg. He said, quote, I looked away, and when I looked back, my knife was in his chest area. I remember pulling the knife out, and Dan fell to the ground. Carl said Gerald asked him which side of the neck had vital arteries, then used the knife to cut Dan's neck. Carl said, quote, I couldn't move, I just stood there looking at him. After killing his former friend and lover, Carl and Gerald went back to Raleigh, disposing of the clothes and weapons along the way. During several court proceedings, it came out that Carl and Donna were not the only ones with murder in their hearts. On July 17th, the day before his murder, Dan wrote a letter to his friend, Bill Poole. Bill's brother was an SBI agent. In the letter, Dan asked Bill to deliver an enclosed letter to his brother. The letter contained a list of drug dealers that Carl had put together at some point because he was planning to help in the prosecution of the drug dealers in order to get a better sentencing and the pending firearm charges against him. Dan asked that Bill deliver the letter to his brother, quote, to ensure that Carl pays until it hurts for what he had done to Donna and me. In the letter, Dan wrote that Carl had pressured Donna into a relationship after Dan told her about his past. He said Donna gave in to Carl three times but came to her senses. Dan said he wished Carl was dead and would kill him if he could get away with it. He asked Bill to contact a special friend to inform the drug dealers that Carl had become an informant against them. Carl had once told Dan that if some of the drug dealers ever found out he gave up their names, they would kill him. This way, the blood wouldn't be on Dan's hands, at least not directly. Dan ended the letter with, I want him dead and will not rest until he is. The next day, Dan's friend, Daniel Statton, went to Dan's office to warn him that he thought he saw Carl's car in Clinton. This news angered and frightened Dan, who wanted nothing more to do with Carl. Dan told Statton that he wanted Carl out of the picture and asked Statton to kill Carl. Statton said no, and Dan brought up the idea of contacting the list of drug dealers himself to get the ball rolling quicker. Staton insisted that this was a bad idea, because Dan could be the one killed instead. And later that day, Dan was killed, but not by drug dealers. It seemed like they all had reached a boiling point at the same time. Jury selection for Donna's trial began on February 15, 1988, and took place in a neighboring county because of the publicity the case had garnered. Because Carl was allowed to plead guilty to second-degree murder, the judge said he would allow second-degree murder to be a possible verdict for Donna. He said it was fair for Donna this way. And though Donna's attorneys objected to this, they were overruled. The prosecution also only wanted the jury to deliberate on first-degree murder. They based their case on the theory that Donna was guilty of murder as an accessory before the fact. In order to get a first-degree murder conviction, the state would have to prove three things beyond a reasonable doubt. 1. The principal murderer, Carl, committed the murder in the first degree. 2. Donna was not present when the murder occurred. And 3. Donna procured, counseled, or commanded Carl to commit the murder. The state also had to prove that Donna, quote, caused or directly contributed to the death of the victim. The prosecution argued that Donna was a lying, scheming woman who plotted to kill Dan out of greed for the $200,000 insurance payout she received following her husband's death. The prosecution relied on the letters Donna wrote to Carl to show that she had conspired to kill Dan. They also pointed to several calls made between Gerald Tart's home, where Carl was living at the time, and the Arnold home, the week of Dan's murder. Donna had originally said Dan was the one who made and received those calls, but she later admitted it was her. At Donna's trial, Carl testified that while he was in prison, he figured out that Donna had only used him to get rid of her husband and was having an affair with someone else at the time of their involvement. Donna's defense said she was not an accomplice. Instead, she was a victim of Carl Stuffel's, quote, evil and dark world that was forced into her life like a cancer. The defense said Dan's cause of death, multiple stabbings, was, quote, typical of one homosexual lover who has been rejected by another, and that Donna was the victim of, quote, manipulation, depravity, and homosexuality. They also called Dan Arnold, the victim, a sick man. They argued that Carl was a master manipulator who befriended Dan because he was facing trial for firearm larceny and wanted a respectable character witness. After moving in with the Arnolds, Carl used Dan's homosexuality to blackmail the family and make Donna have sex with him. The defense said Carl would touch Donna in public in a sexual way in front of Dan to humiliate him. The defense painted Donna as a loyal wife to Dan, a man they said, quote, had fallen ill with homosexual tendencies. The defense also needed to discredit the damning love letters that the prosecution had based much of their case against Donna on. They argued that Gerald's mother, Barbara, used the letters to help her son in a plea deal, and that she could have created the photocopies by taking multiple letters, cutting them up, and pasting them together before making copies. The defense said one of the letters, which was postmarked on July 11th, asked Carl, how is the new job? But Carl didn't interview for the job in question until July 12th, and didn't start working there until the 13th. The defense said, quote, you would have to believe she had ESP or some way of knowing the future to believe she wrote that. Originally, the defense wanted to have a layperson testify and submit documents showing that he took some letters, cut them up, and pasted the various words and phrases together to form new letters of a different message, and then copied the letters. The judge didn't allow this testimony because it was an experiment and was also unfairly prejudicial to the state. The defense was still allowed to bring up the theory, they just couldn't use the documents. In response to this, the prosecution had an SBI handwriting analyst testify that there was a high degree of belief that the letters could have been written by Donna. However, the analyst said they couldn't know with certainty without viewing the originals. The defense also asked the jury not to believe anything either Gerald or Barbara said because they were professional criminals, and anything Carl said because he was a homicidal maniac. They also pointed out how different Carl and Gerald's testimonies were. The defense told the jury that Dan and Donna were like Adam and Eve, and Carl was the snake. Her attorney said dramatically, quote, this is sort of a reverse Garden of Eden. The seduction of Dan leads to the seduction of Donna. In Paradise Lost, an epic poem by John Milton, Satan looks and sees Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden in bliss. He sees innocence, goodness, but he can't have them because he's Satan. So he seduces Eve and thereby seduces Adam. Adam and Eve lose their eternal bliss and their eternal life. The defense said Carl could see the Arnold house from the shopping center parking lot, meaning that he could have seen Dan drive from the house to the church and didn't need Donna's help to kill Dan. They also had around a dozen people, including Dan's own parents, testify to Donna's character. They said she was an honest, generous, caring, loving, gentle, and peaceful woman. Dan's parents, Robert and Marjorie, told the jury that they had an unwavering belief in Donna's innocence. Robert said, quote, "I haven't known anyone with any better character." He said he and his wife talked with Donna about the allegations that she had sex with Carl. He said Donna was surprised that we knew and sorry we had found out. Donna told her in-laws that Carl had forced her. Robert also said he still loved his son very much after finding out that he was gay, saying, "And I want his murderer punished." In response to this powerful testimony, the prosecution said that the people testifying to Donna's good character simply didn't know the other side of her. Donna testified in her own defense. She said she didn't initially tell the police about her relationship with Carl or the incidents between Carl, Dan, and herself because she wished to protect Dan's reputation. About those love letters, Donna said, quote, "I have no knowledge of these letters. This appears to be my handwriting, but I did not write the letters." She also said, "These are not my letters. The words are not mine. I would never write a letter that told Carl Stuffel I loved him. I loved my husband very dearly." According to Donna, right before Carl moved in, Dan asked her to allow Carl to impregnate her. Dan had had a vasectomy and wanted Carl to be a substitute father. Dan told Donna that Carl needed an ego boost, so sleeping with him would help solve that problem too. Donna recalled that at the time, she was upset about Dan's request, which got Dan all worked up, and she eventually agreed in order to calm him down. Later, though, Dan decided the idea was inappropriate and dropped it. At trial, Donna said Carl raped her and then blackmailed her by threatening to tell everyone that Dan was gay. Donna said she didn't tell police that Carl raped her because she still felt threatened by him. She testified that on or about July 6th, she told Dan that Carl had forced her to have sex with him. Dan became very angry and visibly upset and said that he, quote, "just wished there was some way he could get even with Carl." Donna insisted she never gave a church key or a map to anyone. She never wrote that she loved Carl, and she never discussed killing Dan. Carl Stuffel was called as a rebuttal witness for the state. During his testimony, Carl swore he was telling the truth, saying that while he initially lied to police, he decided to tell the truth after talking to his attorney. When asked if he was gay, Carl said he was bisexual when he met Dan, but was now heterosexual. Carl told a much different story than Donna, claiming that their relationship was voluntary and lasted several weeks. Carl said they had sex about every other day for weeks and said he loved Donna deeply at the time. Later, Carl's therapist, Bill Dubrick, from the Dorothea Dix Hospital, testified that he had witnessed an uncomfortable amount of physical contact between the Arnolds and Carl. At first, he thought the physical contact he saw between Carl and the Arnolds was somehow religious, but he eventually realized it was sexual in nature. At the time, the hospital staff had to ask them to stop touching each other because it was disruptive to other patients. In early July, when Dan told Carl to stay away from his family, the therapist testified that Carl was depressed after his stuff was returned, and he was sure Donna still loved him and wanted to be with him. During Carl's therapy sessions with Dubrick, they would discuss Carl's options for the future, and Carl said on multiple occasions that he could kill Dan. Dr. Dubrick also said Dan was warned several times about Carl's threats. On March 16th, after about 3 hours of deliberation, the jury found Donna guilty of conspiracy to commit and second-degree murder. She was immediately sentenced to 15 years for murder and 10 years for conspiracy, and the sentences were to be served consecutively. Donna and much of the courtroom were in disbelief at the verdict. She had to be carried out of the courthouse on a stretcher and treated for shock before being sent to the women's prison in Raleigh. The following day, on March 17, 1988, Carl Stuffel was sentenced to life in prison for second-degree murder and 3 years for conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. Donna's attorneys appealed the verdict on the grounds that second-degree murder should not have been a possible verdict, and that by adding second-degree murder as a verdict, the trial court violated State v. Strickland, which says that a trial court is not required to submit lesser-included offenses as possible jury verdicts where there is no evidence to support lesser-included offenses. A little over 2 years after her conviction, on June 5, 1990, the Court of Appeals ruled that the trial court had erred by allowing second-degree murder as a possible verdict. They overturned the second-degree murder conviction. The court did not overturn the conspiracy conviction. The court said the conspiracy conviction was based on Donna's agreement with Carl to have Dan killed. Additionally, the court ruled that Donna could not be retried for first-degree murder because conviction of second-degree murder acts as acquittal of first-degree murder. They also ruled that double jeopardy would attach if she was retried for just second-degree murder. The Supreme Court of North Carolina upheld this ruling after the state appealed. The court said that if the jury had only been able to pick between first-degree murder and not guilty, they may have picked not guilty. According to the Court of Appeals, quote, "Generally, the submission of a lesser-included offense invites jurors to disregard their oaths and to reach verdicts by compromise." On December 5, 1991, after serving less than 3 years, Donna was released from prison. 22 years after Dan Arnold's murder, on August 18, 2006, Carl was paroled. Donna is a free woman today. At the time of researching this case, Carl has had no other sentences in North Carolina. To my knowledge, he remains a free man, now in his late 50s. A Clinton local named Sherry Matthews wrote a book on the case called Hymn of Commitment, and not long after, in 2016, a dramatized movie adaptation of the book was released titled Tarnished Notes. You can't get the book on Amazon. It was published locally in Sampson County, and the movie was trashed by critics, with the local actors being called amateurs. You can't buy the DVD, and I didn't find it streaming. One thing that really bothered me in the research was so little background on Dan Arnold. His photo doesn't appear in newspapers. His tombstone isn't even on Find a Grave. It's like he became a footnote in his own murder, as the salacious details of the Arnold's marriage and relationship with Carl Stuffel were splashed across the news. Carl and Donna's photos always ran with these stories. Everyone forgot the humanity of the 32-year-old minister who was brutally murdered, a man tortured by his own truth, who felt forced to live a lie. John Milton wrote, "Freely we serve, because we freely love, as in our will, to love or not, in this we stand or fall." Southern Fried True Crime is produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched by me and Haley Gray, and it was also written by me and Hannah Newcomb. Southern Fraud's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. Thank you to Dave Russell for suggesting today's case. I've been reminding y'all, but don't forget to come and find our new Facebook group. Search for Southern Fraud True Crime Fans Discussion Group. We are still worshiping our patron saint, Dolly Parton, and sharing memes and delicious recipes. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shit ass is allowed. It's not just a motto, it is how we run the group. Please submit case suggestions to Southern Fraud truecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept suggestions on social media, and I apologize if I am unable to answer your email. I get dozens of suggestions a week, and it takes time to go through and check out each case. I will definitely contact you if I plan to use the case you submit to see if you would like to be credited on the episode. Thank you all so much for sending in these suggestions. I truly get my most interesting cases from listener suggestions, so keep them coming. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.